coming to you from the Motor City.
Hello, and welcome to the final episode of Season 2. We once again asked for your input, requesting ideas on how you, our listeners, would dispose of a body. We, of course, do not condone murder or body disposal, but thank you all for your answers. The doctors will now be taking those answers, from burning a body to staging a suicide, they may even mention pigs, and debunking them. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Detroit's Daily Dine. I'm Dr. Lachman Sung, and we have all four of us in studio again for our final episode of Season 2 of Detroit's Daily Docket. And for today's episode, we're going to step back from the serious nature and introduce a little bit of comedy and, of course, forensic pathology into this topic. And we are going to talk about ways in which it is actually very difficult to disguise the act of a homicide and evade detection from the forensic pathologist. There are various things that we're going to talk about, and some of them are a little lighthearted, but it is not meant to make light of the situation of a homicide. And we have a number of scenarios, and throughout the season, we've asked our listeners to give us some suggestions on ways in which they think that they can dispose of a body. And also on our Instagram, we've requested that from our viewing audience. So we're going to go over some of those today. And let's first start off with Dr. Laverty.
While the other doctors are going to take the tact of trying to dispose or get rid of a body, I am actually taking a different tact, wherein you want the body to be discovered because you staged the murder to be mistaken for either a suicide, accident, or natural death. Staging a death requires a lot of planning, intimate knowledge of policies and procedures of local law enforcement and the local medical examiner or coroner's office, and some level of cooperation from the victim. In other words, successfully staging a death requires the participation of others whose actions you truly cannot predict and thus is ultimately your undoing. Let's start with staging a death as a suicide. This requires a combination of history, scene information, specific autopsy findings depending on the modality, and the lack of other autopsy findings that are a red flag, and thus these are almost impossible to pull off. We previously said that you don't need a suicide note or voiced or texted suicidal thoughts to rule a death as a suicide. But we do need some history of depression and indication that ending one's own life is not out of context. In other words, if someone who was a bright, cheerful, positive individual was found dead of an apparent suicide, the investigation would be more thorough and would be your undoing. If you decide to attempt a suicide note, how do you get your victim to write their own note? And be careful to attempt typed, emailed, or texted notes, as computer and IT experts can find their way to the correct source and author. Then which method do you choose? Drug overdose or hanging or gunshot wound being the three most popular ways of committing suicide. If you choose overdose, with which drug? Over-the-counter or prescription or illegal? And how do you obtain the drug without leaving a trail? If it's illicit or prescription and the victim does not have a history of drug abuse or a prescription for that drug, then the investigation becomes even more intense. And how do you get the drug into your victim? If they are not willing, then a struggle will ensue and leave injuries on the body or a scuffle at the scene that will be your undoing. Okay, so maybe you'll slip them a Mickey and have them drink something that is drugged. Well, this works in movies, but in real life, there is actually a change in color, consistency, and taste that the victim will realize and recognize as being out of the ordinary. And if your goal is only to render them unconscious with the Mickey, how do you get the remaining drug into an unconscious person? Okay, so now let's move on to hanging. It is impossible to hang someone who is conscious and unwilling without leaving injuries on the body that indicate a struggle and are a red flag for it not being a suicide. If you intend on drugging them first and then hang their unconscious body, toxicology is performed in suicidal cases, and knockout levels would be another red flag. And don't forget, it's extremely difficult to hoist the unconscious body of an adult, and thus you will probably need an accomplice. And don't even think about strangling someone and then staging the death to resemble a hanging. Last season, we explained in detail that the injuries seen in strangulation and hangings are different and can be differentiated at autopsy regardless of the scene or circumstances. Okay, so that leaves gunshot wound. A contact gunshot wound fired by oneself or another would look the same, but the devil is in the scene details. How did the victim get the weapon? You have to leave the weapon at the scene because the dead cannot make their own gun disappear, and its history will be traced by the investigators. They test for fingerprints, not just on the weapon, but also on the casings, as the victim presumably loaded their own weapon before pulling the trigger. So how do you go about to get the victim to load their own weapon? And of course, pointing and holding a gun up to someone who does not want to die will likely cause them to resist, and thus again leave injuries on the body that are a red flag. And toxicology will reveal anything you had them take to make them more easily overcome. Okay, so then how about staging the death as a natural? Well, this also is nearly impossible to pull off, as any detail in the history scene or autopsy that is not expected or is out of the ordinary will increase scrutiny into the case. The idea that if a middle-aged man with a known medical history is found dead in his home and there are no obvious signs of foul play, that the death will be certified as a heart attack without any investigation is simply not true. Officers will still make the scene, as do medical legal death investigators. Remember, it's their job to doubt and suspect everything in order to exclude foul play. In other words, deaths are homicides until proven otherwise, and not vice versa. And of course, a complete autopsy with toxicology and microscopic examination will eventually get to the truth of the matter. The only possibility with successfully staging a death as a natural is to do so without leaving a mark on the victim or signs of struggle at the scene. So this pretty much leaves poisonings and scaring them to death. Scaring them to death works in theory if the victim has known and significant heart disease. But heart disease is unpredictable, and even in the presence of severe coronary vessel disease and previous heart attacks, a person can live a very long life that is full of surprises and shocks and scares. In other words, you might die before your victim does. Modern toxicology is very sophisticated and nuanced discipline, with the scope of testing and interpretation of findings getting better and more comprehensive every day. We will delve deeper into toxicology in season 3 of this podcast, but given what toxicologists can detect nowadays, I would not suggest this route if you are trying to escape detection. Now, listeners did suggest two very specific ways of trying to get away with murder by having the deaths ruled as natural or accident. One was by an allergic reaction to bee stings or a known drug or food. The bee route requires the victim to play along or otherwise be incapacitated, which again would not escape detection, and it requires the bees to play along and sting the victim multiple times. There needs to be an explanation as to how and why the victim got stung. There would be evidence of the stings and internal swelling of the airway, including microscopic evidence of edema and an allergic reaction. As for an allergic reaction to a drug, not even Quincy could pull this one off. The victim needs to have a known allergy, and you have to get them to unknowingly take the drug or food. Drug and food reactions are not always predictable or reproducible, and the victim can start to get swelling or feel funny that tells them that they ingested what they are allergic to, and thus they will end up preventing their own death. And then finally, Dr. Deanna Oleski suggested a second method in a Woman of Forensic Pathology Facebook group, a method that was discussed with her by Dr. Francisco Diaz when she rotated through our office here in Detroit as a medical student. Now, this method is actually one that I first espoused to Dr. Diaz, and now it is the one that I get the honor of debunking. This method requires injection of insulin into the crevice between the buttocks, and it is based on the difficulty and complexity of diagnosing insulin overdoses after death. Glucose levels in your system begin to drop immediately after death, so while hyperglycemic states can still be diagnosed after death, hypoglycemic states are more difficult. And your body naturally produces insulin, so one has to differentiate between insulin produced naturally and injected into the body. Now, keep in mind that while it is difficult to detect an insulin overdose, it is not impossible and it can be done. This method will require you to choose a victim that has known heart disease, inject insulin into a part of the body that can be easily overlooked, and since the injection was missed and thus not suspected, an insulin overdose will not be looked for, and the death theoretically would be ruled as a heart attack. Now, this method is actually undone by the details that lead up to the toxicologist finding the injected insulin and thus the correct cause of death. You have to choose a victim with heart disease significant enough to result in death, and how do you go about knowing that information? You have to obtain insulin and small caliber needles. You have to stick your victim without them reacting or leaving injuries and in a place that is not usually examined. And although I did initially suggest the butt crack, the truth is that even that part of the body is thoroughly examined, as experience has shown us that many surprises can be found in the examination of buttocks, anus, and rectum. Thus, in summary, staging a death to disguise a murder may seem attractive to those of you who want to prove that you are the smartest person in the room, but you are always undone by the unpredictability of those that you need to unwittingly play along with your plan.
Well, thank you, Dr. Laverty. I think some principles we should apply to all of these scenarios are, is it plausible? What are some of the materials you might need? Is it easy or is it difficult? And what are the autopsy findings? Now, as you mentioned, staging a homicide as either natural or accident, the autopsy findings will not change. We will see what we will see. So that one is equal amongst all the scenarios that you presented. As you mentioned, ease or difficulty of injecting someone in the butt crack, I imagine very hard.
Without them knowing.
And materials, you have to be able to gather the insulin. And I'm not sure how many people are just walking around with easy access to insulin. Then plausibility, I think overall, very low on the plausibility scale.
Agreed.
All right. So anybody else want to jump in with theirs?
I think my scenario probably would be best to go next, since it's quite similar to Dr. Laverty's. It was suggested to us on our Instagram. Maybe some of you may consider this a little more out there, but one worth talking about. Let's use a situation that I've talked about previously in an episode. Let's say I have a very cruel attending during fellowship and I decide to seek my revenge on them. I'm just gonna randomly pick one of my attendings, Dr. Sung, my fellowship mentor.
Well, you've shot me already.
I've already shot you, so people understand. And again, just clearly a hypothetical, picking at random. In order to hide this crime, I decide to hide the body in plain sight. I decided to do this crime in October so that I could hide the body like a Halloween decoration. Yes, listening audience, this was actually suggested to us. So again, let's discuss the scenario plausibility in general, such as materials needed and ease or difficulty. Although this may seem so outrageous, let's try to reason through our listener's suggestion. Let's think about the materials that may be needed. Again, it's in October. So prime time for Halloween shopping. These materials, Halloween decorations, would be widely available. For instance, if I wanted to put Dr. Sung in a costume. Any preference, Dr. Sung?
I like skeletons.
Skeleton it is. A costume may be used to hide the identity of a person as well. I also think that I would not need to clean the area of the crime because it's the right time to have a gory or gruesome scene. I may utilize other Halloween decorations to support that I'm a festive residence. There are many gruesome Halloween decorations, specifically bodies and body parts. I'm sure all of us have either decorated for Halloween or have seen our neighbors do it. Also, I've heard every year of stories of police being called on homes due to lifelike gory decorations being mistaken for actual individuals. Now, would this scene be easy to stage? As Dr. Laverty stated before, it is extremely difficult to lift or even reposition a body. Thus, to move a body to imitate a Halloween decoration may be quite difficult. Although I'm fairly strong, I don't think that I could move Dr. Sung by myself. As Dr. Laverty said, you would need an accomplice. Dr. Reyes, you want to help me?
Yes, for sure, if you want to.
All jokes aside, let's now move on to the autopsy findings. This is where I think we can debunk many of these scenarios. Unlike a Halloween decoration, a body, especially outside, goes through decomposition. Dr. Laverty explained postmortem changes in episode 4 of this season's Detroit's Daily Docket. Remember, we see decompositional changes in a matter of hours. Thus, I think based on the appearance as well as the smell, one would be able to conclude that a decedent was not a Halloween decoration. Furthermore, hiding a body would just hide a body. Any injuries on the body would remain. Thus, when the body is eventually found, so will the injuries. In my hypothetical scenario, the injury was gunshot wound to the abdomen. gunshot wounds and their wound tracks can still be visible with decomposition, and they are fairly well preserved. We can't forget that Halloween only lasts one day. Although many people may tolerate winter holiday lights up past December, I don't think Halloween decorations are widely accepted. I think although a creative suggestion by our audience, this one can be easily debunked.
I agree. I think something that people don't remember, or at least don't think about, is dead bodies attract flies, for example. Mm-hmm. So if you happen to have a dead body staged as a Halloween decoration with a gunshot wound to that person, there's going to be a bunch of flies being attracted mm-hmm. to the body and the wound. So if you walk past a Halloween decoration which is swarmed by flies, I think you'd be cued in that something is not quite right.
Agreed.
With this.
There's also the smell. Movies and TV shows ignore this fact all the time.
No smell-o-vision.
Yeah. For instance, you will be next to a decomposing, rotting zombie, and you don't know that
exactly.
they're there, whereas the smell will give it away. And even if you have a decreased sense of smell, your eyes will start to water around some of these decompositional mm-hmm. changes. And certainly Halloween decorations don't smell or make
exactly.
you cry.
Also, dead bodies leak a lot, so there will be a pool of body fluid underneath the body that was staged to look like a decoration. So I don't think this would work.
So it might be a little trick, but definitely no treat with that. Bad joke. I'm full of bad jokes. All right. So I think I'll pitch in with mine. And actually both of these scenarios that I will be talking about have definite pop culture references. The first one I'm going to mention is dissolving a body. We had so many responses on our Instagram about using chemical means to dissolve a body. Some of the acids that were suggested were muriatic acid, which is a form of hydrochloric acid. There was another one where it was mentioned to use sulfuric acid. And then a third referenced Breaking Bad. Now, for those who haven't watched Breaking Bad, I'm going to give a little spoiler alert for that. But Breaking Bad revolves around the main character of Walter White. And he was a high school teacher who had a high school-age son and a pregnant wife. And when he wasn't teaching at school, to make ends meet, he'd work at a car wash. One day, a little bit after his 50th birthday, he was at the car wash and he collapsed. They took him to the hospital and he found out that he had lung cancer. Now, obviously, that would throw a psychological wrench into anybody's plans. And he was worried that he really didn't have the resources for his family after he died. So what did he do? He decided to start cooking methamphetamine and also selling it. He partnered with one of his old high school students, Jesse Pinkman. And in the first episode, it happens that one of Jesse's ex-accomplices was killed by Walter White using some poisonous gas. And I'm not talking about poisonous gases, but that left both Mr. White and Jesse with a dead body. Moving into episode 2 of Breaking Bad, Jesse is contemplating how to get rid of this body. And Walter White says, you need to go to the store, buy hydrofluoric acid and a plastic tub. And the hydrofluoric acid will dissolve away the body. So Jesse, being not the brightest, he goes into a hardware store, buys some hydrofluoric acid, and tries to find the appropriate size tub, but he's not able to. So he just gives up, goes back to his house, hauls a dead body up some stairs, throws it in his bathtub, and then pours hydrofluoric acid over the body. And he goes down to his kitchen, and he smokes some drug. And during that time, Walt comes into the house and asks Jesse what's going on. And Jesse tells him that he was able to get the body up the stairs and pour the acid, but he's very upset because Walt didn't help him. And as they are talking, Walt finds out that Jesse put the dead body in the tub, which alarms Walt, and both of them go to the hallway, and then they see red goo dripping from the ceiling, and then the bathtub falls down onto the floor. So because of that, many people think that you can actually dissolve away a body using hydrofluoric acid. Now, as I mentioned, our listeners talked about hydrochloric acid, sulfuric acid, and hydrofluoric acid. Now, as far as acids go, any substance that gives off the proton is classified as an acid, but they have different strengths. Now, I'm not going to go into chemistry because I have erased much of that from my brain, but the strength of an acid depends on its ability to disassociate, or the dissociation constant. And it just happens that hydrofluoric acid is a relatively weak acid compared to hydrochloric and sulfuric. So in the order of strengths, hydrochloric acid is the most strong, then sulfuric, and then hydrofluoric. Now, although hydrofluoric acid is relatively weak, it is pretty reactive, thus reacts with tissue. And after watching some Mythbusters and some YouTube videos where they recreated this Breaking Bad scene, hydrofluoric acid actually takes quite a long time to dissolve away tissue, and it does so at it's actually pretty poor at it. It's interesting because the hydrofluoric acid will interact with the heme group to make a very clear sludge, unlike sulfuric and hydrochloric acid, but in the end, it takes a very long time for this to happen. And in fact, back in 2011 at the American Academy of Forensic Science, there were two Italian physicians who studied this specifically. I don't know that they followed around some Italian mafia, but they happened to have a lot of information about Italian mafias. And one of the methods that the Casa Nostra mafia used was they had these elaborate torture mechanisms that they would torture their victims with and extract information. And they also tried to conceal the corpse. They called this Lupara Bianca. They would bury people. They tied people to weights and threw them in water. They also tried to burn people. And one of the ones was melting them with acid. So these two physicians, they took some pig knuckles and they submerged them in sulfuric acid. And they literally just watched to see what happened. And after a short while, 30 minutes or so, the muscle started to take on a cooked appearance and started getting kind of slimy. After 2 days, the muscles were very loose. And it wasn't until day 6 that the bones just started to become eroded. So in that controlled experiment, it took a very long time for this to happen. And this is on pig knuckle. If you expand that to a human body, it would take a very, very long time. So using our 4 criteria, plausibility, you first have to get a dead body. Materials, it would take a lot of acid. I'm not talking just a little bit. You'd have to obtain a lot and also be unnoticed. If you go down to Home Depot and you just start buying gallons upon gallons of muriatic acid, someone's going to take note. Is it easy or difficult? It's actually pretty difficult because you have to have your containers, you have to have a way of venting fumes. And after you, let's say, use the acid, you have to neutralize it because you can't handle this highly acidic solution and think you're going to be okay just flushing it down your drain. And then the autopsy findings, you may loosen up the tissue and the skin on the outside of the body, but the internal organs will still be intact. So all in all, not a good method.
You had mentioned Mythbusters, and I know that we here in the office are huge fans and that we dearly miss that show. They actually did quite a few myths involving dead bodies and did so in a very thorough way. And we here are still trying to find a way to do a publication on falling bullets. And yes, that was my takeaway from it. I heard white noise about all sorts of chemistry, a little bit about dissolving bodies, and then Mythbusters.
All right. Anybody else?
So most of our followers on Instagram suggested the pig method to dispose of a body. Someone said that her relative used that method, and I will talk about this method in disposing of a body. So murderers looking to dispose of a body ultimately seek 2 things, speed and thoroughness, and pigs offer both. The digestive systems of pigs are like the human ones, are meant to break down protein and carbs. A pig's capacity to eat flesh depends on its sex and age. Fully grown boars do not eat as much as lactating sows, which can eat 10 to 14 pounds of saw feed every day. An average American man is 5 feet 9 inches tall and weighs about 195 pounds. Assuming that pigs are hungry enough to fill themselves to max capacity, 14 lactating saws would be enough to make a body of a grown man disappear in an hour or two.
You're kidding me.
Yes, I found this online. And this method has been used for many years. The famous Italian Sicilian mafia and several serial murderers used to dispose of their victim bodies by feeding it to pigs. So I will talk about examples that I found of this. So a famous example is the worst serial killer in history, whose name is Robert Picton. This man killed 49 women and fed their bodies to pigs. He was a Canadian pig farmer who mainly preyed upon drug addicts and prostitutes, picking them up in Vancouver's red light districts before driving them to his farm, where he had sex with them before murdering them in a variety of horrific ways, like injecting his victims with antifreeze syringes or stabbing them before feeding them to the pigs. When he was finally arrested in February of 2002, it was almost by chance. Investigators had raided his pig farm looking for illicit weapons, only to find items belonging to long-missing women. A search of Picton's farm revealed DNA evidence of 26 missing women, and the pig farmer was charged with their murders. Another example is an American farmer from California whose name was Joseph Brigham. Joe had a special talent for raising hogs. Competitors used to ask him for advice on raising such large and healthy hogs. He used to say that it was all in the feeding. Whatever he did, it worked, because he collected top dollar for his hogs when it came time to auction them off. To maintain his farm, Joe needed a steady influx of workers. He regularly visited San Francisco and found transients to work in his farm. Although he couldn't pay a salary, the transients received room and board as payment. At first, the transients considered it as a fair deal, but eventually they wanted more than that. After Joe told the transients he could not afford to pay cash, they left. Workers stayed anywhere from a couple of days to a few weeks. In 1902, after finishing a day of work, one of his transient workers looked underneath his bed and found two severed fingers. The man informed the police, who returned to the farm the following day and searched the property. They found at least a dozen skulls and the remains of several human victims. Investigation revealed that after Joe rejected paying his laborers, they tried to leave. Unknown to them, they were moments away from being murdered. After Joe shot his workers to death, he butchered their remains and then fed them to his hogs. Joe could have simply buried the bodies, but he preferred feeding them to his hogs. Supposedly, he thought human remains made the pigs grow larger and taste better. His customers must have agreed, because they often say Joe's hogs were plump and mighty tasty. Authorities arrested Joe and then convicted him of murder. In 1902, he received a life sentence to San Quentin. His life sentence was a short one. In 1903, he died in prison. Pigs can do what flames, chemical pits, and drowning can't, and very fast. But in reality, pigs' stomachs cannot digest hair or teeth, so that leaves DNA evidence. Plus, in order for the pigs to feed on the body has to be chopped into multiple pieces, which will also leave a significant DNA evidence on scene.
Obviously, pigs have quite the appetite, but unlike Dr. Webb, I don't happen to have pigs as pets.
I think that's the biggest issue is where can you get pigs and where is this pig farm? Mm-hmm. Here in Detroit, I don't think I've seen many pig farms.
And not only that, the pigs have to be starved so they can start feeding on the body. And these have to be lactating sows instead of an adult boar.
You know, I think all of us being here in Detroit, we were astounded at how many listeners we had that suggested the pig route. There are no pig farms near us. But I do have to say, for those that have pet pigs, as we said in the postmortem changes episode, that your dog will, if they get hungry and they are around your dead body, will start nibbling on the tender, fleshy parts. So I'm beginning to realize that pigs would do the same, mm-hmm. but probably wouldn't stop at just the tender parts like mm-hmm. the fingers and the nose and the lips. And I wonder how long it would take the pigs to.
Yeah, and some websites, it was mentioned that it only takes 8 minutes for a group of pigs to eat a body.
Once again, you need that group of pigs.
Exactly. Yes.
You need more than one, of course.
Starved pigs. Right. A group of 14 starved pigs.
And then you have the
DNA
evidence left from the pig's feces and on scene from chopping the bodies.
So plausibility, sure, pigs will do it. But is it easy? Definitely not.
No, I don't think so.
Since we're talking about the Italian mafia, let's go to one of their other ways in which they try to get away with murder.
Okay, hold on. Stop for a minute. Seriously, I did not know that the Italian mafia.
I was like, I had to reference it.
I'm listening to all of you, and I'm like, oh my God.
This is perfect. Pig knuckle, so, burning.
So apparently the Italian literature has to be filled with like all of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I found like recent incident where the Italian mafia fed a man alive to pigs. And they recommend that once you feed pigs a human being, you should kill them immediately because they can
get a taste and
kill people, live people.
Hannibal.
I now see a horror movie.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. So I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I'm like, oh,
no,
my God.
No, that's okay. I had to say something like, again. Let me start with another hypothetical situation. Again, I decide to lure Dr. Sung into an abandoned house here in Detroit. I surprise him, then again, shoot him in the abdomen. Again, my MO in my episode 5 of the season's podcast. To cover up the crime, I then wrap Dr. Sung's body in a tarp and drag it to the basement. I take gasoline that I brought and douse the rooms. I ignite the accelerant using a lighter and hope that the fire destroys all the evidence. What do you think, Dr. Sung? Do you think I could get away with your murder?
First off, I'm not going anywhere with me.
And why don't you lure him to the basement instead of having to drag him after being shot?
See, I'm bad at this. So again, let's discuss plausibility in general. To see if something is plausible, I think we should consider how common a fire is and the ease or difficulty to start a fire. So as far as frequency, when I was doing some research, I read that there are around 350,000 house fires in the U.S. per year. Specifically, there's around 8,000 fire-related deaths in the United States. When I queried our office in particular, we've had around 10 so far this year of accidental fires. With these stats, do you all think this scenario of house fires causing death plausible?
I think it is possible.
Mm-hmm. Because of the frequency of fires, I think it is plausible that we can decide a homicide as a fatal event that occurs so frequently like a fire. As far as ease of starting a fire, can we all make a fire?
I don't think it's very hard. There's lots of ways you can make a fire.
Agreed. Especially if you have the right tools. In my case, I would need an accelerant and lighter. I don't know, people who do camping, I don't camp. I'm sure you can find other ways of making a fire.
I think if you're trying to dispose of a body, you're not going to be using a ferro rod to strike some sparks. You're going to use
flint of some kind.
This isn't a survivor challenge.
Exactly. We have stores here in Detroit. Yes. So the materials that are needed, again, something to ignite a fire like matches or a lighter. And then an accelerant is always described. In my case, I use gasoline. These items I can see being easily bought at a hardware store or even a grocery store or a gas station. Although the amount of gasoline may raise some eyebrows, I'm sure I can talk that away. In my scenario, I also discussed utilizing a tarp to move a body. Again, something that can be easily bought in a hardware store or grocery store. Something that many people may forget in this type of scenario is that one needs proper amount of time to have a fire. How long do you all think it takes for a fire to consume a house?
I think it depends on the type of structure, you know, mm-hmm. brick home versus mm-hmm. a one with wood. I don't know myself. I've never burned down the house, but I think it would take a while. But even if the fire is established, you have to make sure no one calls the fire department to put
exactly,
it out.
Exactly. All very true, Dr. Sung. When I was reading about house fires, new homes actually require only minutes to be completely gutted or charred. The reason for this is that they're made of different materials than older homes. In newer homes, you have more synthetic materials, which are made up of hydrocarbons, which in itself is a solid form of gasoline. So that's why newer homes tend to ignite more swiftly than older homes. So, Dr. Sung, I'll invite you to a newly renovated abandoned home. As Dr. Sung also stated, there are actually other factors or variables when considering a house fire. Typically, again, as Dr. Sung said, someone notices a house fire and calls the fire department. According to the National Fire Protection Association, the standard for response time for all fire departments is around 5 to 10 minutes. Thus, a house fire probably could be quickly extinguished depending on the response time. All that aside, I think that this would seem like a reasonable way to obscure a death, seemingly an accident. But as we medical examiners know, forensic pathology has been able to discern homicides and fire-related deaths, particularly due to what we see and find at autopsy. This is where I think we'd be able to debunk this scenario. Again, remember, in my scenario, I set the house on fire utilizing gasoline and a lighter. Remember, in forensic pathology and autopsy, we rely on the circumstances surrounding the death. So, in cases where a building or a resident has a fire, we rely on fire reports, which are done by experts in the field. Fire experts are individuals educated and trained in analyzing the evidence in the aftermath of a fire, and they attempt to determine the cause of the fire. These experts may also be able to tell us other details, including the location of the start and if accelerants are used. They may also relate this to the position of the decedent. In my scenario, it is likely that a fire department expert would be able to determine that an accelerant like gasoline was used in the fire, and thus not due to accidental smoking, electrical malfunction, or appliances. Furthermore, if, say, I left the gas containers behind, these tend to be dent and corrosive resistant, and thus more resistant to fire damage. It is likely that this evidence would not be completely destroyed. I've had many cases in which I requested the fire report. How about everyone here?
I do that frequently.
Mm-hmm. I think it's key to the forensic investigation.
Exactly. Again, back to my scenario, I wrapped Dr. Sung in a tarp so I could move him into the basement. The position of the decedent in a house fire can actually help with the circumstances surrounding the death. In accidental fires, if an individual is younger and able-bodied, we may see these decedents in close proximity to entrances or exits. This shows an attempt to escape, which most individuals would try. Thus, seeing a reportedly healthy adult, like Dr. Sung, dead in the basement should raise some suspicion. In regards to moving a body, like before, Dr. Lavity did express how hard it is to lift a body, let alone reposition. Now, on to the tarp. Although this may seem like a minute object, tarps itself can be helpful at autopsy. Most tarps are made with some durability, specifically made to be heat or fire resistant or retardant. Thus, actually covering or wrapping a body with a tarp would help protect the body from any fire damage. Last but not least, moving on to the autopsy findings. So again, remember, I shot Dr. Sung. On a personal note, this step is highly unlikely because I truly enjoy and highly regard Dr. Sung. But also, Dr. Sung, you've seen me handle a firearm. Bad aim, really bad aim. All jokes aside, Dr. Sung explained in his firearm fatalities episode in season one that gunshot wounds can and most typically cause injuries with a specific appearance. Thus, in order to obscure an entrance gunshot wound and possibly an exit wound, I would need to specifically be able to burn or char that area of the body. In my case, the torso or abdomen. I also would need to obscure all the penetrating injuries that the bullet may have caused. In this case, the gunshot wound could penetrate the bowel, stomach, kidneys, liver, aorta or vessels, and soft tissue. Gunshot wounds in live individuals also cause a significant hemorrhage within tissue. that I would also need to ensure would be burnt. Furthermore, depending if it's a penetrating or perforating gunshot wound, there may be also bullets or remnants of bullets left behind in the body that cannot be easily burned. Although it may seem like it, it is actually extremely difficult to burn an entire body without the proper equipment or tools, like a crematorium or an incinerator. House fires rarely generate a high enough temperature to truly cremate a body. You not only need high temperature, but also lots of time.
You know, I think that out of all of the methods that have been suggested that we have discussed and that you guys will be discussing, this burning of the body is one that we do see, whether it is to obscure the crime or to obscure identity. Mm-hmm. And as any forensic pathologist or coroner or police officer knows, it very rarely, you may obscure the external surface of the body and therefore you think you're obscuring the crime and identity. We still have DNA and dental with which to identify with, and every internal injury is still perfectly preserved. So although we might not be able to tell you inches from top of the head and from midline where that entrance wound is located, all of the internal injuries and the bullet are still recoverable. So in the end, you don't end up hiding anything. You just end up adding additional charges onto what they are going to be going after you for, because now you are desecrating a corpse and trying to cover up a crime.
If Dr. Lavi remembers, we had cases where there was significant consumption of multiple areas of the body, but prints could still be lifted mm-hmm. from the hands, and we can still determine even some external injuries on the surface of the skin. So just as Dr. Nguyen said, it's very hard to consume a body. And if you then suggest, well, why don't you bring the body to a crematorium? Well, you have to have access to a crematorium.
Exactly.
And these are not easy things to do.
I'm not an expert in crematoriums, but upon my reading, I found out that it takes around 1,400 to 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit for 1 to 3 hours to incinerate an entire body. To give you perspective, a house fire produces probably only around 900 to 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. Why do you need such high temperatures? The reason for this is because the body has such high water content. The water within the body needs to be evaporated before one can properly disintegrate tissue and organs. The high water content may also help to smolder a fire. When we have fire-related deaths, the bodies typically are charred on the outside, and the extremities and head may be severely damaged, but there is usually preservation of the internal viscera or the torso. Thus, in my scenario, the body may be charred or have thermal injuries, but I likely would have preservation of the gunshot and the gunshot wound tract in the abdomen. Furthermore, it is extremely difficult to burn bones due to its composition. I think there is a misconception that you can burn human bones to ash. In crematoriums, remnant fragments of bone are actually ground or pulverized to become ash. Thus, also any damage to a gunshot wound may have done to the bones, such as ribs, pelvis, or spinal cord, could still be discerned, especially with the help of our anthropologists. As Dr. Reyes had said before, teeth are also difficult to destroy, and specifically to burn. Thus, we tend to utilize teeth, dental records, and our odontologist, Dr. Berman, who has spoken in this podcast, to help identify bodies. Now, remember that in fire accident deaths, there are also other causes of death, not only thermal burns, such as smoke inhalation, and specifically carbon monoxide intoxication, should be evaluated. This helps us to determine if a decedent was alive at the time of a fire. We see evidence of this at autopsy, seeing soot within the nares and in the airway. We can also see a significant amount of inhalation of carbon monoxide with a cherry red appearance of the muscles, internal organs, and blood. A more definitive test of this is by toxicology analysis of the blood by carboxyhemoglobin saturation. In my scenario, Dr. Sung died by gunshot wound prior to me setting the house on fire. Thus, he would probably have no carbon monoxide or smoke inhalation, and that's very little, if any, carboxyhemoglobin saturation on toxicology. It has been discussed that a more effective way to burn a body is in parts over an open grill-like surface, somewhat similar to a funeral pyre. A grill-like surface allows for the fire to be maintained. Fires are most effective in an upward direction due to oxygenation. Also, fat from body parts would help fuel the fire. But again, this situation could not obscure a homicide entirely. This would need lots of time to not only dismember a body, but then to burn each part. Per literature, it takes around 35 minutes to completely burn flesh of the thigh at 2,400 degrees Fahrenheit. As I said in regards to a house fire, remember, you cannot obscure all injuries and fire damage at autopsy because a fire alone does not result in a body becoming completely ash. So clearly, although TV shows and movies make it seem easy, we as forensic pathologists have many ways to discern homicide, even in fire-related deaths.
On to more disposal of bodies. Once again, my topic is pop culture related. So one of the scenarios that was proposed was to place a body into a wood chipper. Now, for all of those who have seen the movie Fargo, this is something that they actually did in Fargo. Now, I'm not going to tell you about the whole movie Fargo, but essentially there were two fugitives played by Steve Buscemi and by Peter Stormare. It happens that Buscemi's character was getting on the nerves of Stromer, and Stromer ends up killing Buscemi with an axe. Now, we didn't cover axe deaths with our sharp force injury or our blunt force, but it sort of has features of both sharp and blunt, but that's for another day. Either way, Stromer kills Buscemi's character, and he tries to dispose of the body by feeding Buscemi's body through a wood chipper. Now, for those who are not familiar with wood chippers, there's lots of different grades of chipper shredders, not necessarily for wood, but in general. To lay a little foundation, think about your garbage disposers at your own house. Now, depending on the unit that you buy, the typical horsepower of those garbage disposers, once again, in your home, are either going to be 1/3 horsepower, 1/2, 3/4, or 1 horsepower. Now, a 1 horsepower garbage disposer for your home is quite intensive, but that's about the range for in-home use. Moving on to wood chippers, now these are not official categories, but you can have those for consumer people like you and me. Commercial, these are the arborists, the people who cut down trees, and these are large units that you can rent at your Home Depots or your Lowe's. And then there are industrial chippers. These are the type that you see in large landfills or junkyards where they are large enough to actually crush cars. So the one that was used in the movie was a Yard Shark 8 horsepower Briggs & Stratton chipper. Now, that's, I'd say, on the medium of the consumer end of wood chippers. And if you've never chipped wood, it can be quite exhausting and quite dangerous if you're standing too close to the chipper. If you are feeding branches, there is the risk of the wood chipper throwing the branch back at you. So in the scenario in Fargo, there is the risk of, as Peter Stormare is chipping Buscemi's body, that parts of the body be thrown out of the wood chipper and hit you. In extending the scale to commercial-based wood chippers, these are the large units that you rent at Home Depot, they can reach into the 25 horsepower, 30 into the low hundreds of horsepower. And that is a lot of power to chip something, but these are very large units. And the question is, could one of those chip a human body? It's actually pretty unlikely, because wood chippers are designed to chip hard objects, wood specifically. And the human body, although it does have bone, which is hard, it has all that soft flesh around it. So if you feed something soft and fleshy through a wood chipper, it might, well, not might, but it would cause serious injury, but it's very likely that the soft tissue will get gummed up in the blades of the wood chipper and cause the engine to fail. And thus, you're left with a body that's partially in the wood chipper. So that does not really dispose of a body. And even if you're able to feed parts of a body into a chipper, such as the fingers and the hands, you still have that DNA evidence all over that machine. And I guarantee you, when you try to return that commercial chipper to Home Depot or Lowe's, they're going to wonder what's going on. So they have your driver's license. They have your information. So you can't get away from that. Now, if you think about using an industrial chipper, most of us don't have access to that. So on the plausibility scale, although it can happen, it's not very easy, because you'd have to convince a junkyard to allow you to haul a dead body and then throw that dead body into their chipper. And even if you were successful in that, you still have that DNA evidence all over that machine. So as far as using a wood chipper, not a good way.
Well, one of the ways that was suggested by someone is consuming the body, meaning eating the body. this is not a usual method to get rid of a body, but rather than maybe a sign of mental illness. An example of this is Armin Miewes case. Armin was a German former computer repair technician who achieved international attention for killing and eating voluntary victim in 2001, whom he had found via the internet. That wasn't to dispose of his body, but to fulfill his human flesh-eating fantasy that he had for over 40 years. For the next 10 months after killing his victim, the man feasted on the body with red wine, potatoes, and sprouts. He also added it as pizza toppings.
Oh, no.
Authorities eventually found human meat in his freezer, a skull in the garden, and a videotape recording of his act. This guy is still incarcerated. Clearly, this is not a good idea to dispose of a body because you have the skull and bones to hide as well.
Yeah, there are antibody methods of determining whether or not tissue is human versus animal. Mm-hmm. So even if you had that in your freezer, they could tell if it was human.
Yes, for sure.
Now, in my research of wood chippers and whatnot, I did find an interesting, I don't know if you call it instrument, or interesting device that is used to digest tissue. These are called thermal tissue digesters. These are huge machines in which they place carcasses of animals into them. They lower a lid and increase the pressure, temperature, and add some caustic agent to it. During the cycle, they agitate the tissue and essentially digest away the carcass. And the purpose of it is for animals that have prion infections. So this digester is able to neutralize prions. So it's quite industrious. And some of them can handle a couple hundred pounds, and the large units can handle over 10,000 pounds of carcass.
Wow.
And the interesting thing about it is the end product, you can have two types. You can have the liquid remains of the tissue, and that liquid is essentially neutralized and then flushed down the standard sewer system. Or they can produce a solid cake of animal, not really tissue left, but it's a cake. And the benefit of the cake is that it is easily disposed of in a landfill. So if you happen to have $800,000 and a thermal tissue digester, then okay, sure.
How big is this?
It is incredibly large. Mm-hmm. If you imagine how to, a unit that can hold 10,000 pounds worth of tissue.
Oh, okay.
And this is a unit that is huge.
Okay, and with a play on words, if you create a human cake, I wonder what Mr. Armin would have done with that.
Agreed.
I had a great time. I learned so much about all these different ways that people think that they can get away with disposing of a body. But hopefully, by the end of this episode, you realize it is actually very difficult. And the findings during the autopsies commonly are still preserved. So we can still determine if a case is a homicide or not. So don't run your bodies down to Iowa where there's a bunch of pig farms. Don't buy a lot of gasoline. Don't get in contact with the Italian mafia.
And don't rent a wood chipper.
Right, don't rent a wood chipper. So you thought we were done. Nope, we have a little bonus for you. For all of you that have followed us through seasons 1 and 2, something that we've tried to emphasize was that we, as medical examiners, are just one part of the medical legal death investigation. What we want to do now is branch out to the legal aspects of death investigation as it pertains to this episode's topic. So we just spent the last hour exploring the difficulties in obscuring a homicide, but what if there is no body? Is the legal system still able to bring people to justice? I can't answer those questions. I know what my lane is, and I stay in it. I am no lawyer, so we have on the line Allison Arnold, and she is the senior trial attorney for Monroe County, Michigan. She was kind enough to take time out of her busy schedule to help us close out our season. Now, before we get into my question, can you give our listeners just a brief introduction of yourself?
So my name's Allison Arnold. I'm a senior trial attorney with the Monroe County Prosecutor's Office, and I prosecute homicides and other felony cases.
Okay. So the episode that we're currently in is the last of our season, and essentially we debunk some myths about how difficult it actually is to obscure a homicide. So I'm going to give you a hypothetical. Let's say that there's a suspect and he chops up a body and feeds it to his pigs. And there literally is no body for us medical examiners to look at. I always thought that if there was no body, then a case couldn't go to justice. Is that a myth?
That actually is a myth, and you can prosecute a case without a corpse if you can prove the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, sometimes that gets difficult, of course. I think the confusion comes from the corpus delicti rule, and corpus delicti actually means body of the crime. And it comes out of early English cases where there were several situations where they executed a person for murder, typically after the person confessed to the murder, but then the dead person would then show up alive. So that was a problem. Mm-hmm. So they created this rule, and how the corpus delicti rule works in Michigan, it means you cannot use a confession of any crime without establishing the body of the crime independent of the confession. Now, how that works in homicide cases is you have to show, when there's a confession, you have to show the body of the crime, and that would be the death of the victim and criminal agency as the cause of the death. And oftentimes you can make that out when there's a confession through other evidence. Now, the death of the victim, typically I pulled some cases that we can talk about because they're illustrative. The death of the victim is typically proven when there's a confession, when the confession comes a long time afterwards, by the fact the victim's been missing for a long time. Maybe they've had no contact with family and friends. You know, they may check different states to see if they applied for a driver's license, if their social security number was used, if they ever filed taxes. And if none of those things happened, they're usually presumed dead. Mm-hmm. I found one case where this wasn't a Michigan case, where it was a cruise ship. And of course, if someone's pushed off a cruise ship and they're not recovered, we can presume they're dead, even though we don't have the body.
Right.
Now, criminal agency gets a little tricky. And there's three cases that I want to talk about, where two cases where it was able to be proven that criminality was behind the death, and one case where the prosecutor could not prove that to show corpus delicti. Now, the first case is the Brassett case, and that's a case where witnesses saw a man enter a van with the victim, and he was talking to her that he wanted to engage in sexual relations with her, and she was saying no and fighting him, and they observed a physical fight in the van where he assaulted her for 10 or 15 minutes, and then he left the scene. And the court felt that that was enough to show criminal agency was the cause of the death when death was proven by her not being located for a long time. That defendant was picked up on another murder case, and in confessing to that other murder case, he confessed to the murder of the woman in the van. Mm-hmm. Another case, Medelsky, was a husband and wife case where she'd been missing for years. The husband confessed to several people years after his wife was missing that he had killed her. But the criminal agency was shown because they had a very bad relationship. He had initially, or around that time, had accused her of being unfaithful to him. A coworker said that a song came on that was called Kill My Wife, and he had a very strange reaction to that song. And not long after she died, he gave all her stuff away to a new girlfriend. So they said that was enough to show criminality was likely the cause of her death. Mm-hmm. In the McMahon case, this is one where they found there was no criminal agency. It was a person who The body was not found, but there were over 44 witnesses about the person being missing and the circumstances of that. And in that case, the victim was last seen alive with the suspect. She said she was going to his house and would be back by midnight. And even though he confessed to her death, the court said that there wasn't enough to show that criminal acts caused her death. So that's how the corpus delicti rule works. And we don't have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. It's just by preponderance of the evidence. So a little bit more evidence than not. And if we can prove that, then we can use a confession. And when someone confesses, then we can convict them even without the body. Mm-hmm. But even without a confession, if you can prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt, there is no requirement that you need a corpse to prosecute any homicide case.
Well, I'm sure that debunks a lot of the myths that people have, and mine too.
Yep, it's quite an interesting topic. Mm-hmm.
So that I have it straight. If you prove the elements of the crime with a confession where you can meet the corpus delicti rule, or with evidence without a confession, you can still prosecute.
As long as you can prove the elements beyond a reasonable doubt, that's correct. No requirement to have a body.
Okay. Well, thank you, Allison. I'm happy that we were able to get you on, and hopefully our listeners will enjoy this little addition to our episode.
It was my pleasure.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, this concludes Season 2 of Detroit's Daily Docket, but we will still have our Instagram up.
Yes, so our Instagram will be still running, and we'll share interesting anatomic findings once every week. So please share this with whomever is interested.
And if you have suggestions or topics that you want to hear for Season 3, definitely share those also. We'll be happy to look through them and see what we can do. So we will talk again. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Detroit's Daily Docket. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Detroit's Daily Docket. Our theme song is Living by Read the Sun, and our podcast cover art is by Hollow Wicked Prince. Thank you for listening.